came from Sinai to Jordan. Is it on? Are you recording? Start over. They left Egypt. They came to Sinai within a few months. They left Sinai after a few months and went to Jordan. That's no more than 18 months from the time they left Egypt to the time they were at the Jordan. It was God's intent that they would go into the land and he would give them the land foot by foot wherever they set their foot. And the classic story we all know so well that it almost becomes more of a story than an event. But it is a true historical event. 12 men were sent out to reconnoiter to find out information on the land and its people. 12 came back. 2, believing God, said, "We can have what God promises to give us." 10, looking not at the promise, but looking at the giants, the inhabitants, said, "We can't take the land." That the size of the inhabitants is greater than the faithfulness of God and his promise. That's what it boils down to. So they did not enter the land because of their unbelief. It froze them. It paralyzed them. And not was it only that the 10 said that they cannot because they didn't believe God, but it says the rest of Israel agreed with them. They heard the report and agreed with the evaluation of the report that the size and number of the inhabitants is a greater power than the faithfulness of God to his promise. That was the unbelief. God promised. Men were big, and they chose to believe and evaluate based upon the size of the inhabitants rather than the promise of God. That's called unbelief. That is a very clear picture of what unbelief is. When Paul says in Corinthians, we walk by faith and not by sight, it's the same distinction in that statement are included as in the case of Israel not going into the promised land. Because what these 10 spies and the rest of the Israelites were doing was evaluating or walking by sight what they saw, not by faith, in God and what he promised. And it is true in the New Covenant. We're to walk by faith in what God promises and not by sight by what we see or hear by our senses. Though our senses may reveal great obstacles, when God has promised something, even though what we can see seems to present great obstacles to prevent what God promises from coming true, we are to choose to walk by faith in what God promises and not by sight that would seem to prevent the fulfillment of the promise. You got that? That's the way? Okay. Now, our job is to know what God promises. Our job is to know what God promises so that things that do not normally and naturally happen can be brought to pass. It would not have been normal or natural for Israel to take the land without the promise of God. It was naturally impossible. It was normally impossible given the natural kinds and results of warfare. When a people fought against another people that was stronger and taller and mightier, they would lose. That's normal. That's natural. You would naturally conclude that. So for any outcome in our lives to occur that are other than natural and normal, we need a promise of God that addresses that and promises that our lives will be lived not just naturally and normally as our nature would have us to live, but that we would live not just by our nature, but that we would live according to the will of God. We wouldn't just live according to our flesh and our nature and the way that things would work by nature, but that we would live according to the will of God, what his purposes are in us being here. And it's his promises that reveal to us how we can live and how we can live as in description, different than just living naturally like a dog or an animal would live, according to our nature. The promises reveal that. And the only way we will live other than just according to our nature like an animal is to know that God promises and then mix it with faith. Mix it with believing. What would have happened if they had believed God according to his promise instead of believed their eyes according to the natural? What would have happened? Huh? They wouldn't have spent 40 years in the wilderness. Okay? What else would have happened? Jason? Would have taken the land right then. History would have been different. They would have actually gone in and taken the land, and those that were occupying would have been driven out, just like the subsequent generation was. And more than just wouldn't have wandered for 40 years, a whole generation would not have died. Because it wasn't the same. The people who eventually went in were not the ones who were in unbelief. They never did enter. So it wasn't just a delay of 40 years. It was a wiping out of a whole generation. And that's the worst part. One thing to wander for 40 years until you finally are permitted to go in. But those that were in unbelief, they didn't enter in. God had them wander specifically so that those in unbelief would die off in the wilderness. Do you remember what their excuse was? Their complaint was in facing the possessors of the land and their complaint about against God for being in that circumstance. Do you remember that, Michelle? Yeah. You are so concerned about your children that you offer them up as a reason not to go in because you want to protect your children. And he said, I will protect your children and give them the land, but not you. So God demonstrated that they had no reason to use their children as an excuse not to go in. But he demonstrated he could protect the children. Okay. Hebrews chapter 11, verse 6. Everyone probably knows it. Hebrews 11:6. Wendy, would you read that out loud, please? Hebrews 11:6.
And without faith, it is impossible to please him. For he who comes to God must believe that he is, and that he is a rewarder of those who seek
him. Okay, everyone out loud. And without faith, it is impossible to please him. For he who comes to God must believe that he is, and that he is a rewarder of those who seek him. And again, and without faith, it is impossible to please him. For he who comes to God must believe that he is, and that he is a rewarder of those who seek him. What is necessary to please God? Wendy?
Faith.
Without it, what? It's impossible to please him. What can you do without faith? Is there things you can do without faith? You go to church without faith? Give alms for the poor without faith? Stand on the street corner praying without faith? Fast without faith? Give without faith? Speak about God without faith? You can do multitudes of things without faith. You could probably make a giant list of things you can do without faith. And on that giant list would not be one thing that would please God. If it's without faith. Amazing. Isn't it amazing? Without faith, without confidence, without trust in God, it is impossible to please Him. God is not pleased with anything that is without faith. Is it possible to please God? Isn't that amazing? It's possible to please God. Micah, do you know how to please God? Through faith. Believing God pleases God. Without faith, nothing pleases God. With faith, everything pleases God. We're back to the either or. Andy, more of that. There's nothing, there's no in between. We please Him or not pleasing to Him. Either we trust Him and have faith in Him, or we do not. And you can't mix any, you can't give any combination of things without faith that will please Him. You can't do it long enough, or hard enough, or well enough, or right enough, or perfect enough. Without faith, it won't please Him. And that's the testimony of God. And this whole chapter is a list of people who pleased God because through faith they left lands and they left houses, and through faith they endured this and passed on that and denied themselves this and was faithful in that. And through faith is these testimonies of those who pleased God. I want you to turn back to Numbers. Keep your hand in Hebrews 11. Numbers chapter 14. Without faith, it is impossible to please Him. Memorize that and believe it. If you won't believe Him, believe that. If you're not yet willing to enter into believing God, at least believe this statement. Without faith, it is impossible to please Him. Go to bed at night believing, confident that without faith it's impossible to please Him. Know that that's a fact and believe it. That's something that you can put your foot down on the ground and drive a nail in it. Never have to move it. You never have to revisit that fact, that truth. That is a forever settled fact. Without faith, it is impossible to please Him. You never have to revisit that and with a new idea about it that might turn it over or upset it or nullify it. That's a fact of relationship with God that is forever settled. Without faith, it's impossible to please Him. Now, Numbers chapter 14, And this has to do in Numbers 14 with the grumbling beginning. They begin to grumble from the report of the ten in unbelief. They begin to grumble towards God. And Joshua and Caleb give and reinforce their report. Chapter 14, beginning with verse 6. And Joshua, the son of Nun, and Caleb, the son of Jephunneh, of those who had spied out the land, tore their clothes. And they spoke to all the congregation of the sons of Israel, saying, the land which we pass through to spy out is an exceeding good land. Exceedingly good land. If the Lord is pleased with us, then he will bring us into this land and give it to us. Isn't that amazing? Huh? Joshua is speaking with an understanding of what pleases God. Because he knew that the issue was trusting God or unbelief and complaining. And he was saying, if we please God, he will give us the land. They were trying to counteract the unbelief that was boiling in the hearts of the people through the testimony of the ten spies. He didn't say, if we go into the land and destroy its occupants, we will please God. Did he? He didn't say, if we will go in and take the land, God will be pleased with us. He said, if God is pleased with us, he will give us the land. Now, why did Joshua say that God would give them the land? On what basis did he say God would give them the land? Okay. On the basis that he believed? But why did he believe that God would give him the land? Because God said he would. Okay. Joshua was referring to the fact that God had already promised to give the descendants of Abraham the land. He wasn't just sounding, encouraging that here's this great land and maybe God will give it to us. But he wasn't trying to put God in a good light by saying, if we please God, he'll give us this land, like as a reward for pleasing him. He wasn't doing that. He wasn't pulling an idea out of the air that if they please God, God will give them the land. He was going way back to the promise that was in effect from the time of Abraham to that day, and said, if we please God, he will fulfill his promise. God had already said he would give them the descendants the land. If we please God, he will give us this land. It's a good land. If we please God. Without faith, it is impossible to please him. He was trying to counteract the unbelief that was like a plague going through the people's minds and hearts. They were believing the report, evaluating according to sight, according to flesh, what the natural thing would be in those circumstances, and completely discounting the promise of God. Now, what do you do when you discount the promise of God in a circumstance like this? We're not talking about laying on your bed at night and the promise of God comes to your mind that you read in the Bible, and in some kind of vacuum of intellectual thinking, you reflect upon this promise and don't exercise faith in it. I'm not talking about in a vacuum like that, an intellectual vacuum where you have a promise that comes to your mind and there's no application to be made to it. You're not faced with the object of the promise, but obstacles standing in the way. When I'm not talking about just an intellectual case where you think of a promise and then don't do anything about it. I'm talking about real life where these people are really standing under Jordan. 12 of them really went across the Jordan for 40 days, walked around in their cities and countryside and spied them out, came back. I'm talking about just the land that was promised them was really right there. I'm talking about the report was really negative, full of unbelief. I'm talking about others began to sympathize with the unbelief. I'm talking about their whole future was on the line of which way they would go, into the land or who knows where. Now, under those circumstances, when you discount the promise of God, what are you discounting as well? Ron? In what way? Excuse me? Okay, Ron says you're discounting evidence for faith. Micah? You're discounting the person of God. You have another thought? Character of God. God himself. When you discount his promise, you're discounting him. When God makes a promise and you are faced with the circumstance that a promise addresses, not just an intellectual moment in a vacuum, but you're faced with the very circumstances that promise and those circumstances were intended to match. And if at that time you discount the promise and go according to the flesh, going according to what you see, you're discounting not just the promise, but the promisor. You following? That's crucial. Because when you discount the promisor, what are you calling him? Nancy? A liar. It is an accusation against God that he is a liar when what the promise is intended to address and that thing is face to face and you're faced with the necessity to believe God because it's directly facing the circumstances the promise addresses. And to not believe God at that point in time in those circumstances is to discount the promise, discount the promisor, and call God a liar. Unbelief is not just a lack of faith. It is an active, it's not just a negative lack of something, it is a positive denial of something. It is calling God a liar. Now people don't in their minds go, God, you're a liar, we can't have this land. When the 10 spies said, they're too big and we can't have the land, it wasn't God's a liar, but it's equal to saying God's a liar. You follow me? It's not as though in the heart of unbelief, a person is conscious of the words in their mind going, God's a liar. I believe God's a liar. What they can be conscious of is that they are facing this temptation, they're facing a trial, they're facing various things that promises directly have connection to, and when they choose to live according to their feelings and their desires and their senses, rather than promises that God has made that directly connects with that, they're conscious of going with the influence that they go with. They're not conscious of saying God's a liar. But it's equal to believing that God's a liar. You cannot trust him. And you have a promise in him. What's another thing that is implied when the 10 spies and the people said they're too big?
God is not bigger.
God is not greater than the problem or the difficulty or the issue. That they are, by what can be seen, they are bigger. So these are big, bigger than God. What's the only conclusion left? Their conclusion was, we can't have the land. But if they were to have the land, what would be their conclusion? Their conclusion would have to be, we're not going to be able to get it from God. You'd have to devise some way to be bigger than them, or more than them. Because if at that point in time, in their mind, God and His promise isn't sufficient, if they're ever going to have the land, they're going to have to find a sufficiency in their numbers, in their strength, in their tactics to God. They're not going to turn to God. You follow me? They got one promise from God. They're not relying on that. So they're going to have to turn to something else if they're ever going to get the land. 10 generations later, if they come back to the same place, if they're still in unbelief, they're still going to have to find a way to overcome the occupants in their own devising. They're going to have to calculate their own way to get this land. Except, see, they got there through the miracle of God sending Moses and God doing miracles through Moses and God meeting them in Sinai and God feeding them and all these to get them there. And God doesn't repeat that often. It's not as though every generation is going to be brought back to the same place to give them a chance to trust God and get the land. And that is true in our lives. That is true in our lives. We really don't repeat our lives over. What you went through today, tomorrow is another day, just somewhat different. There are different things in it, and you're never going to repeat today. And you're not going to have tomorrow to be faced with what you need to trust God with today, and trust God for today, and you can't say, I'll do that tomorrow. If you're faced with the need to trust the promise of God today because your life matches what He promises regarding it, and you don't trust Him today, then today you weren't pleasing to Him. Because tomorrow is going to require that you trust Him tomorrow under those circumstances according to the promises He makes for those circumstances. You can't procrastinate when you will trust God. You can't put it off and say, I will trust God when, and have some idea when you're going to trust God. I'll trust God when my kids get old enough to where they're not so pressing on me. They're not, you know, when my kids get a little older, they get better trained, I'll trust God then. Get a little bit more money, a little bit more reliable car, then I'll trust God. That's when I'll put my faith into operation. Right now, I'm just sorting things out, but there'll come a day when I'll trust God. That's unbelief speaking. Without faith, it is impossible to please Him. It is said that the saddest point of Israel's history, when they were faced with receiving exactly what God promised, and they didn't receive it. Now, what is the application for us? The book of Hebrews gives us some application to ourselves. What is the application? We are to make an application from this. Hebrews authorizes us to apply this and learn from it and avoid their error. Avoid their catastrophe through unbelief, because it was a catastrophe. A whole generation died because of unbelief. are we to be different than Israel at that point in time? Can you think of Scripture's direction to us? How are we to, are we directed to learn from this? Okay. Okay. Walk by the Spirit and you will not fulfill the lust of the flesh. Be led by the Spirit and not the flesh, the feelings, the desires. Do not walk according to those influences. And we will, in fact, walk by faith. Yeah. Is there any specific directions from the Scriptures that, Michelle?
And also in 2 Peter 12:1, let us also lay aside every encumbrance and sin, which so easily entangles us, and let us run with endurance the race that is set before us, fixing our eyes on Jesus, the author and perfecter of faith. For the joy set before him enjoyed the cross, despising the sin, was set down at the right hand of God. I just read the whole letter.
Let's look at the third chapter of Hebrews, because it specifically references that event when through unbelief they did not enter in. Starting with verse 12, take care, brethren, lest there should be in any one of you an evil, unbelieving heart in falling away from the living God. We are to take care, lest. In other words, since there is the possibility without taking care, so let's take care and avoid that. What is possible, and that is that there should be in any one of you and of us an evil, unbelieving heart. God calls an unbelieving heart an evil heart. So unbelief is not just a lack of something. It is a positive evil. But encourage one another day after day, as long as it is still called today, lest any one of you be hardened by the deceitfulness of sin. Encourage one another day after day to do what? What do you think he would be referring here to? Encourage one another day after day, daily, day after day after day after day. Encourage one another to do what? Okay? To believe. To believe what? Believe God and what He promises. Okay? Encourage one another. Do you do that? Do you encourage another believer to keep trusting God? Don't presume that because you believe they are a believer, they don't need any encouragement to keep believing. But encourage one another to keep believing, keep trusting, because every day brings new circumstances, a repeat of things that are temptations that may have been temptations the day before. They're liable to come right back around since we live in routines and cycles and things like that. encourage one another to keep trusting God. What do you think that would consist in? Encouraging one another to believe God. Well, we're supposed to do it, so maybe we should find out what it is. In specific, we understand that we're encouraging one another in believing God and His promises, but how do you do that? Now we understand what it is, how would you go about doing it, huh? And what would you testify to that might encourage another person to believe God? So there would need to be the actual fulfilling of them by God in your life in order to testify that God keeps His promises. What else would could a person testify to that would encourage another person to trust God? Yeah? God's character, His goodness, His love, His faithfulness, His wisdom, His loving kindness, His mercy, His grace, His omniscience. He knows everything that is to know. He's not going to be caught by surprise. Your circumstance is not a surprise. Your difficulty is not a surprise. The giants in the land are not a surprise to God. Right? Like a spy that came out of the land and said, well, you tried God, but it didn't work. That's a discouraging statement to see, not an encouraging one. We have a license plate that said, proved God. Proved God. Tried God. No doubt he tried God. Tried and failed. What else would encourage someone else to trust God? Think on that, because the Holy Spirit tells us to encourage one another day after day, day by day. So think on that. This is something that we are to do to one another. Your faith, your trusting God, in a living faith, living it out in a trusting life is, through your revealing it and testifying to it, the source of encouragement to others to do the same. Your walking in faith is of great value to the encouragement of other people. Do not discount the value you have in walking in faith to the encouragement of other people. People do need to be encouraged to continue to trust God, and it comes through people who do it. And that's how they can encourage others, because they have done it. They can encourage others by testifying to what they believe is true about God. He keeps promises. What do you think Abraham would have testified to his life? God promised that through him, his seed, the whole world would be blessed. What do you think Abraham testified to? Because Abraham never saw the world blessed through his seed. Did he? See? What do you think he testified to? He did not testify to the fulfillment of the promise. Okay? Okay, he did get a seed. Okay. Okay. He saw the land, but he never possessed it. That's what a buyer's own grave, right? He did have the fulfillment of having a seed where he could have a descendant that would bless the whole world. So he had the forerunner or the beginnings of the fulfillment of that promise. Okay. Did Abraham believe God based upon God's performance? Abraham is held up as the example to follow in believing God. Okay. Abraham believed God, and God counted it as righteousness, his faith as righteousness. Abraham was justified through faith. Right? And that's, Paul uses that as the example and the paradigm and the model by which we can follow the same teaching, and that is, we are justified through faith just like Abraham is. Now, did Abraham believe God through God's performance? How many shake your head yes? How many of you shake your head no? Rephrase it? Phrase it again? Did Abraham trust God because of God's performance? Did Abraham look at God's performance and then believe God because he saw God perform what he said? How many say no? Okay. Then upon what basis did he believe God? Because God had not fulfilled the promise. On what basis did he, Micah? You had to have faith. But on what basis? Faith has to have a basis. Has to have a reason to believe. That's what I'm saying by basis. And since God hadn't performed anything when Abraham believed him, then on what basis did he believe God? Okay? God is truthful. Okay, Andy? Character.
The knowledge you had of God's character.
The knowledge you had of God's character. The truthfulness of the character. Got it? Yeah. God, Abraham believed that God is able to perform that which he promised. He hadn't performed it yet. Abraham believed that he was able to perform that which he promised, which means he believes that God was truthful in his promise because he believed that he did not promise to do something he couldn't do. He didn't lie in regards to what he could do. He could actually give him a son when he was dead in his body and his wife was dead in her body. He could actually do that. So when God promised that, God didn't lie. He was being truthful. Romans 4:24 reveals that to us. He believed that what God promised, he was able to perform. He was truthful. Can you ever come?
Yeah, I was wondering what Abraham's project that is.
What? That's my question. So your question again?
I'm having trouble understanding where Abraham's knowledge of God's character would be tested and God's character, and that's what leads to God. And he believes God has fulfilled a promise, and where did Abraham get his understanding of God's character to begin with?
Mm-hmm. Does that understand the question? What's the answer? He didn't go to Gospel Truth Fellowship. He didn't go to any fellowship. The teaching that God is love and faithful and truthful. He grew up in a city, in a culture that was idolatrous. His father was an idol worshiper. He was raised in a home of idolatry. Imagine that. Everybody understand the question? What's the answer? Julie? Pardon me? Okay.
In Romans 1:18-19, it says that there are men who suppress the truth and unrighteousness. And then it says that which is known about God is evident within them, for God made it evident to them. The constitution of the world is visible at the traditional power and divine nature has been clearly seen, being understood through what has been made, what they are about to do.
And the answer is?
Every man knows the truth of God, that God is love.
Every man has access to the evidence that God is. And one of the things that pleases God is to believe, and must believe that He is. Right? And that He's the rewarder of those who diligently seek Him. So, in creation, there is the knowledge that God is. The knowledge is there. The evidence of it is there if a person will not suppress it. Okay? Okay?
Very basically paraphrasing it, he just puts it on our hearts. And so he didn't suppress what, I mean, essentially says he didn't suppress what God has already revealed to him.
Okay. So all men have access by the way we're made and the creation that God has made, all men have access to see the evidence that God is. And that he has certain attributes, his eternal power and Godhead. Is that what it says?
Mm-hmm.
What's the exact word? Romans?
His eternal power and
his divine nature. What do you think is an undeniable fact of God's nature that every man would have to agree upon? I want to see some more hands before I call on. How many of you, what attribute of God do you think is undeniable in the minds of all men if they will not suppress it? What do all minds have to agree upon regarding God and His divine nature? Julie? Teresa? That is true. His divine power is manifest, that He's powerful. But as to His character, really? Those are sub. The things that you mentioned are subheadings. Teresa? He's good. And good people are truthful. And what was the other one you had? And good people love. But they're subheadings of good. And good people are just. They don't make a promise and not keep it. Right? Good people can be trusted. If they're good. I mean, if they're good, good. If they're good through and through, they can be trusted, relied upon, they will keep their word, they will keep their promises. And you can rest your eternal soul in a good person's word. And that's all you need to depend upon a person to keep their word, is to believe that they are good. And it's impossible to believe that God has spoken and will not keep His word. It's impossible to believe that God has spoken and will not keep His word. You understand what I'm saying there? It's impossible to believe that God has spoken and not keep His word. Men must deny that God has spoken to avoid the implications. Because once they admit that God has spoken, they know He will always speak the truth. And that truth should be believed. So the mankind's efforts are to suppress the fact that God has spoken. Their job is to not admit that God has spoken. That's why they must deny that Jesus is the Son of God, because He claims to be speaking for God. To admit that Jesus is the Son of God and has spoken for God imposes upon that person the great weight of believing, because if He is the Son of God, what He says must be true and reliable and dependable. Teresa? That was their view of how to treat them. Abraham's faith was not based on performance of what God did, but the fact that it was God who promised. It wasn't that he had a promise and he believed God. His faith was not based upon what was promised like, wow, this is so great, I'm going to believe it. The greatness and the goodness and the magnanimousness of the promise was not the reason why he believed it, because it would really be a good for him. He believed the promise because it was God who made it. And God cannot lie. This indicates to us that he was persuaded that that being that was talking to him was God. He was persuaded that he was being talked to by God, and God was making him a promise. And once you and I become persuaded that the words of Jesus, the words of the Apostle Paul, the words of the apostles, is God speaking to us, when we believe that, it settles. It's unbelief that God is speaking through Jesus and his apostles that keep us frozen and unmoving in our lives and in our actions. The great issue and the great end of all inactivity and paralysis is to believe instead of unbelief. And it's just the most remarkable thing, because you can have read statements over and over again by Jesus, and one day, in a certain circumstance, and God pressing upon you, the need to understand, the need to believe something, and you'll take something that Jesus has said over and over, and all of a sudden that day, to you it is God speaking. For the first time, you see what is being said, and you believe it to be God speaking, and that settles the whole matter. You take it to be God speaking to you and addressing you and supplying you the promise that you need, the knowledge of God's character that you need. The moment that you, your heart believes this is God speaking to you, it settles it. But until that moment, you're still in unbelief and you have no answers. You've no end of the land. You stay outside and you grumble and you complain. Why is this happening to me? Are you going to destroy my kids? Are you going to destroy my family? Wish he'd left me in Egypt and all that. We don't know if God went to somebody else. Abraham's neighbor spoke to him. And the man just didn't believe it was God speaking. We don't know. We don't know that he did. But we know that when he spoke to Abraham, Abraham believed God, and God counted it as righteousness. Unbelief is at the heart of all paralysis, emptiness, dryness, sin, disobedience, and faith, believing. When God has said something, believing it to be God saying it, being willing to believe it is God saying it, radically changes the heart to enter into the land and possess the land and see God drive out the giants just like he said and see his fulfillment of his promises. It's very simple to know. If your life is filled with defeat and sin and disobedience, it's very simple to lay down in your bed at night and say, God, I'm in unbelief. That is why I do not obey you. That is why you're not fulfilling promises that you've made to me. That is why my life is not pleasing to you. Because of unbelief. And you can rightfully count all the things that you do in unbelief and realize, God, you're not pleased with any of them. And when you are trusting God with your heart, when your heart is trusting God, you know He's pleased. You know He is pleased. You just know. Abraham did not trust God because of performance, because he didn't perform anything. He didn't trust God because of the nature of the promise, how grand it was. He trusted God because it was God who promised. Let that be an instruction to you, an encouragement to you. Trust God and direct your mind to understand the nature and character of God who makes promises. If the children of Israel had accounted it that was God who promised them the land, they would have sided with the two instead of the ten. Ten could have come back and said, "We can't have the land." If the people had been people who believed God, because it was God who made the promise to their fathers, they would have fired the ten and taken the two and followed them. And it is true in our lives. When we really realize and believe Jesus is God speaking to us all, we are not sent back to die in the wilderness, but we enter the land and God fulfills His promise to give us all that He promises us in salvation. You want your cup filled? God has made clear promises through His Son Jesus of how your cup can be full, how you and I can be full of the Holy Spirit. And it comes through believing the promise of God, of the Father, to give us His Spirit to those who obey Him. Jesus said, "All you that come unto me, out of your belly shall flow rivers of living water." He said, and John said, and this He spoke of the Holy Spirit. He told them, He said, "Go into Jerusalem until you receive the promise of the Father." The promise. That any lack of the fullness of the Spirit is due to unbelief in the God who made a promise to give us His Spirit. In some measure, there is unbelief connected with an absence of the fulfillment of the promise of the Spirit. In some regard, that's where you're to go and look to find out. And if there's an issue, why the Holy Spirit is not in your life as He ought to be. Unbelief in the promiser is somewhere there. Let's pray.